All right, that's it's on tape, Roz. From here on in, it's on tape. This is the this is the second of three talks about the life cycle, which some people call the wheel of rebirth. And the way we're going to talk about it is not exactly the way it's talked about in the Cosmo Conception, because you can go ahead and read that in the Cosmo Conception. You don't need me to tell it back to you. I'm going to talk about some of the principles involved in that so we can apply it to our lives. But in this talk, because we are going to be talking about some things from the Cosmo Conception, we're going to be doing something that I don't really feel philosophically comfortable about. We're going to talk about some things that most of us may not have had waking objective experience at least not that we can remember. Now, this is not unique to mystical students. It happens frequently with material science. For example, the physicists that I worked for spoke about subatomic particles, which they had not experienced directly, but only indirectly. And they were accepting a whole physical outlook, which they hadn't repeated every experiment that they took for granted. They just accepted the whole business. And a lot of psychiatrists can't see the psyche, and they formulate speculative ideas about how the psyche is composed, and some of them do quite well at understanding what goes on inside the human soul, even though they can't see it. But at any rate, I'm still uncomfortable with the whole idea. And as long as we're talking about mysticism compared to material science, I find that the integrity of the spiritual investigators is much better than the integrity of the material scientists. Because with the spiritual investigators, it is a full-time activity. For the investigators, the only time that they are really keenly observant and scientific is in the lab. And it doesn't carry into their life. And they haven't sacrificed anything of their life in that way to be informed. But for whatever secondhand information I'm going to give you, I apologize for having to use secondhand information, because I'm at that time in life, and I've realized that I've had 40 years, and I haven't yet unfolded the spiritual side. So it's kind of bad when you have to relate a little bit on secondhand experience. In doing this, every effort that I can make to substantiate what is going to be said in terms of things we can experience, I will make that kind of effort. Emphasis is going to be placed not on all the material, but on the things that appear to be most significant for our seeking, so that we can see for ourselves. Now, in the talk preceding this one, we said that the perfect circle, out of which all cycles are patterned, that abstract, perfect mathematical cycle, which can only be seen by the mind's eye, all the points on it are equal. And there are no special points. But there are, in all the manifest cycle, special points. We can even see that in the diurnal cycle. For example, noon equally divides the day. And even though we can't see it, midnight equally divides the night, and those are special points on the cycle. Even more special are sunrise and sunset. If you've ever camped out, you know that before the sun pops across the horizon, it can get awfully chilly. But then the sun comes over the horizon and it lays its light on you and you feel warm right away. So those are special cases. There are points in the life cycle that are also special points. Where we left off yesterday when we were talking about looking forward and being wanting things in life, driving us into the material world and hardening us, including the hardening of our body, just as Max Heindel says, when the desire body is active, hardening is always the result. And looking backward, and that looking backward lifting us more out of the body into the more spiritual and moral sphere. Somewhere in the middle of life, actually earlier than the middle of life, we begin looking back, and that changes it so that most of our life we are looking both forward and back, and there are two different experiences from both. Now, we were proceeding toward the special point in the cycle, and that special point is death. And in one way, death is something like a sunset, because at death, almost all of the forward-going activity is over with. There is no more spiraling forward. There is no more spiraling into matter. The will to live that set the archetype spinning that becomes our life, that impulse of will has been spent. And so death is sort of like sunset, because at sunset, all the photosynthesis stops, because the photosynthesis needs light to continue its building process. Now, we said that somewhere, usually with the births of children, you started watching your children. And you began remembering through them, and you began pondering through them what your own childhood was like, because most of your childhood was forgotten. And all of the processes, all of the developmental processes of childhood, we don't remember them at all. We went through them, we experienced them, we developed things, but we don't remember that. But when you start looking back, you start thinking about those things, you start seeing those things. You know, everybody goes through the period where they read this baby book and that baby book. Oh yes, this is the terrible twos. They're going through this stage now. And they don't realize that those stages are related to our whole spiritual evolution in the past, but that's what we went through. But at death, that process of looking back that began with the birth of children, or at least certainly began about age 28, is virtually unimpeded. With no will to live, to move forward, all of the backward looking is unstopped. And, boy, this is nasty. The will has been spent, and there's nothing holding us to matter. There's nothing causing us to wind further and further into incarnation and to grow harder and harder. The stage immediately after death is a period of only unwinding, or mostly unwinding. Everything seems to go backwards. When we live with our consciousness in such a way that we're only looking forward at the outer world, we're subject to all kinds of illusions. And we develop bad habits of consciousness. For example, if we want to enlarge a house or modify a house, what do? We build on an attachment. We build an L or something like that. Everything in the outer material world is additive. It isn't like that in the spiritual worlds. In the spiritual worlds, everything proceeds from within out. And if there's going to be a major new development that you're going to do something that hasn't that you haven't done before with your body, you go right back to the beginning and you build a new coming from within out, and everything is accommodated by that process of externalization. Everything in the evolutionary creation of which we are part goes from within out. The body unwinds. When we've gone as far out as we can go, the body unwinds, and it unwinds from without in. It's just like dressing. I'll tell you in just a minute. But when you dress in the morning, you put your underwear on first, then you put the next layer of clothes, and if it's like winter here, you end up with your outdoor winter coat. And when you undress, you start with the outside and work your way back in. There's no other way that it can be. You can't take your underwear off first. And that's where something struck me very funny. I played football when I was in high school. It was one of the stupidest things that I ever did. And before the first game, the coach gets you in the locker room and he tells you, these guys might look bigger than you, but they're not any bigger than you. They're not any tougher than you. They're just like you are. They step into their jockstrap 1 foot at a time, just the way you do. Before the next game, the coach comes into the locker room, and here's one character trying to jump into his jockstrap. 2 feet, both feet at the same time. And he was so focused on it, he didn't see the coach come walking up to him. I met him at my class reunion. I didn't recall that to his memory, because I don't think he wanted to remember it. But I can just imagine, since we are these independent, rosy kinds, I can just imagine somebody going home tonight and trying to take their underwear off before. I have seen women take their bras off before they took their bras off. I didn't see them take the balls off. Now, this principle of working from within out and from without back in, you can find it in a number of places in the Bible. Probably the clearest statement of it is the statement, and the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. It's a general principle when you have a system of creation where you work from within out, and then when you undo something, you work from without back in. So, when the impulse to live has been completely spent, and you can go no further, you start unwinding from the physical body, going back the other direction. And immediately, as soon as the spirit takes the higher vehicles and leaves the physical body goes back to being what it really is, a mineral. And we call that mineral-like state, we call it rigor mortis. The body is hard and stiff, like it is a stone, at least until the bacteria set in, because there's no waste anywhere in God's kingdom, so to speak. The energy that was bound up in our bodies, there are, you know, bacteria and fungi and all sorts of little creatures that can benefit from the body that is released in our body after we have left it. And very soon after rigor mortis, the whole thing becomes soft again, but in a different way. The bacteria are benefiting from us. Now, there are some features about the vital body that it is really important to know if we can to understand the disintegration and use it in our own lives. Now, the vital body is composed of the four ethers from the etheric subdivision of the physical world. Now, the Bible tells us that flesh and blood, or biological things, cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven. And since part of vital body is all bound up, and its only activity isn't bound up with flesh and blood, it has to be left behind because it can't inherit the kingdom of heaven. However, when the disintegration process begins, the disintegration applies to all four ethers. Now, the chemical region of the physical world, which is this, the solid, liquids, and gases, is completely outer. But the ethers are different. If we take something here, like one of those apples out there, and cut it open, we don't see the inside of the apple, at least not in the inward sense that the spiritual worlds are like. All we see is another without. To see within is something very different. You're seeing with an inner eye and a different kind of consciousness. Our eyes here see reflections, and our ears hear things that are bouncing. We don't get the inside of things. We can imply what's going on inwardly if we put our intuition alongside of our external perception, but our perception in the external world is only outward. All of the other worlds, yes, they do have an outward side to it. There is a form to the desire body, for example, but it's not as important as the inner side of things. But the ethers stand between this outer physical body and all of the spiritual worlds that are primarily inward. So they have a foot in both worlds, so to speak. And because of that, they have to be responsive to both worlds. And for this reason, the ethers are all polarized. The negative pole of each of the four ethers of our vital body is attuned to physical process. The positive pole of all of the four ethers of our vital body is more attuned to the spiritual world and the carrying out from what things that come from within out. If you take the section and read about the vital body and of the four ethers and do some thinking about it, and you can notice things like this and a whole bunch of other things too. But even the four ethers themselves are polarized. The two lower ethers, or so-called lower ethers, the life ether and the chemical ether, are involved strictly with biological process. Whereas the two higher ethers, the light ether and the reflecting ether, are primarily concerned with consciousness, carrying perceptions and carrying thoughts and carrying out desires and things like that. The division between the two ethers and the polarization is something that has to be dealt with after death. The spirit, which wants to return to its home in the spiritual worlds, is more associated with the two higher ethers, the consciousness ethers. And the two lower ethers are to stay behind with the physical body because there's nothing that no service that they would have to offer. Oh boy, it's hard. Jeez, you can't even flash at notes because of something. Not after death, they do not. So because the etheric body is woven together. It is woven together by this whole within-out and the whole without-back-in. The vital body, all four ethers, are tied together. There's a certain amount of the word that the cosmic conception uses is concentricity, but they are actually really woven together. Now, after death, the consciousness is focused primarily in the two higher ethers. We want to review all of the memories of the life that has just been finished. The law of nature is such that the vital body is going to unspin anyway, but the law of nature serves the spiritual consciousness. So the spiritual consciousness is intent, almost like in a movie theater, at looking at the images, the pictures, which are marvelous pictures. They're like living three-dimensional pictures, like you're reliving your life again, that are passing before it. The review is in reverse order because of this very same unwinding. Now, this unwinding does several things, and it's really, really very important activity. The more intently we look at these pictures, and the more intently they were formed in the first place by living and putting our attention into our life, the more we get out of our life. It is possible for two people to have exactly the same lives, but because one person put more intensity into the life and was intently focused on that living, the pictures are more clearly felt, and you get more experience, and it's easier to retrieve that experience later on. Psychologists know this, even materialistic psychologists know this. They know that because when the vital body is very vigorous in childhood, you live life more intently. And the memories from those times are stronger than the memories formed later in life. In fact, as we become enfeebled and we can't put much intensity in life, the memories are not impressed very strongly at all, which is really saying something, because the sensitivity of the reflecting ether to what is impressed on it is exceedingly subtle, and it's an exceedingly rare kind of sensitivity. So in this, the point is here, for some people who are not familiar with the Rosicrucian philosophy, every breath that we take carries with it everything that is in the environment around us. And it is carried through the bloodstream, and it is impressed on the negative pole of the reflecting ether of our vital body. So every picture of everything we've ever done, whether we're conscious of it or not, is not lost. This is exceedingly important. The creation, the evolutionary creation of which we are part, is exceedingly efficient. Nothing must be lost. In fact, even if your body burns right at death, the material isn't lost, but it takes a long, long, long time before you can retrieve it, and you have to retrieve it in a different way than of what we are speaking. So it takes about 3.5 days for the unwinding of the vital body. And during that time, the spirit, the self, is looking at these pictures. And when it's doing that, it is recording all of that information on the higher vehicles. We'll come to that in just a little bit. Now, there's a big difference between viewing these pictures after death and viewing these pictures in retrospection at night. When we're alive, that will to live is still pushing us forward. Therefore, when we retrospect, as Rod said yesterday, I don't know if he said it quite exactly this way, retrospection is very hard. We're going against the grain. We're swimming upstream because life wants to go forward. And it takes an enormous assertion of will and a sacrifice of love to go backwards. So retrospection during life, if you do that, it's very much more significant because of the effort that you have to put forth in order to do it. It is, as Max Heindel would say, it builds backbone instead of wishbone. He had a lot of great ideas, things he liked to say. So we're going against the grain. And another thing that happens is that when we're going backwards, just like we noted yesterday, the more we look back and reflect on things, the more we are softened and the more we are lifted out of our bodies. So what happens when we retrospect, we're not only swimming upstream, but we're doing an activity that lifts us out of our bodies, and it is very easy to go to sleep during retrospection. That doesn't happen in the vital body after death, because it's automatic. But because it is automatic does not mean that it can't be enhanced. If we have lived lives intently and we have learned how to intently put our consciousness into it, we can get much more out of it. We've already mentioned that one of the effects of it is that it stratifies the vital body. Automatically what happens is the unknitting takes place, so that the two lower ethers are left behind with the physical body, and the two higher ethers go along with the spirit into the inner worlds. Now this also happens in retrospection. In retrospection, it isn't quite as thorough as after death. We'll come to that, I guess, in just a second. The important thing is that we do not disturb the person who has died. Therefore, we want the person, we don't want the physical body to decay during the three and a half days, because things will be lost in the decay process. So the Rosicrucian method for dealing with death, or the procedures right after death, are to take the physical body and put it somewhere where it is cold, where it will not rot, and where it is quiet. So there is nothing that will distract, because there still is a connection. As long as the consciousness is in the higher ethers, those higher ethers resonate with the lower ethers, and the lower ethers still resonate with the physical body. So there is not a direct connection, like if you poke yourself with a pin, that it goes all the way to the spirit almost instantaneously, but there still is a connection. And therefore, if there is anything like a postmortem examination, or embalming, or organ harvesting, or something like that, it completely distracts the person. And while it is a very altruistic thing to give organs and do things like that, it's more of a disservice than it is a service. Because our whole life, we're here for experience. And we dare not lose that experience, or we begin to lag behind in a process that's supposed to have a timing to it, like music. We've been sluggards enough with as much sinning as we've done and as much indulgence as we do that keeps us proceeding more slowly than we should be going, so that we don't want to do anything more to slow the whole process down. So these are really important things. After the 3.5 days, you can do whatever you want with the body. The Rosicrucian Fellowship recommends that you take and burn the body so that there's nothing for the spirit to be unduly attracted to the physical world, even though it is now dissociated from the physical body. It's a good thing to just burn it and get it out of the way. I find that sometimes there are people who will go along with the idea of 3.5 days of silence and being cold, and they don't like the idea of burning. They think of burning, they think of that with hellfire and things like that. And they don't like the idea of burning the body after death. And I find it very easy to make that compromise with families and say, well, just give the 3.5 days in coldness and in silence and with no disturbance. You can do the body with whatever you want. If you want to have a Masonic funeral, and if you want to inter it in the ground, go ahead. The important thing has been taken care of. And sometimes you have to make compromises. I know it's not pure Rosicrucian philosophy, but the important thing is what is important. It is being taken care of in a situation like that. Another thing is that all of the distractions are not necessarily physical distractions. If you think about a person with great regret, or if you are with, you know, if you are wailing and mourning and doing other kinds of things of grievance, that is a distraction. Because your feelings and desires can distract that person as much as a lot of noise, maybe not as much as an organ harvest, but it is a distraction. Now, when this is done, it's done. It's an irreversible process. There is a disengagement. And that disengagement is different than the disengagement from retrospection. With the disengagement in retrospection, you can't be complete and thorough. Because if you were to completely take the light and reflecting ethers away from any association or reassociation in the body, you'd leave a person without sense perception. So the process in retrospection comes very close to being identical, but there is the possibility of re-engaging. But one thing is almost identical, that the ability to leave the body, both the dense physical body, in a soul trip, or even in the things that you're interested in. If you start retrospecting, you're not so interested in carnal things. You're not, you know, you're more and more leaning toward the spiritual worlds. And your connection is looser between the spirit and the higher vehicles and the dense physical body. A person who has a really strong connection with the dense physical body is someone who couldn't even listen to a talk like this. It would all sound crazy to them. Why would I want to deal with a whole bunch of speculation like that? But somebody who is a little bit more loosely connected to the physical, they can hear the siren song of the spirit, and they can hear the intuition, and they are more willing to listen to say, well, there maybe is something to that. Or they can say, yes, yes, that does give me answers. So a person who does retrospection automatically becomes what is called a sensitive. And a sensitive is a person who is not completely focused into the physical body. And this is the goal of all of us. All of us want to become sensitive to such a degree that we can leave the physical body behind and go into the inner world. In some cases, if there is a separation between the higher vehicles and the dense physical body, and it is involuntary, it's a rather unpleasant thing. This is mediums, for example, are sensitives. And instead of having the freedom to do something, they are more the slaves of other beings than most people are. Now, this often happens. The post-life panorama happens and the person doesn't die. Often happens. For years I worked with a man who in his youth almost drowned. And I knew him when he was about in his late 40s. And we worked together. And I was a real problem to him. Because he related to me. He told me the pit story of when he almost drowned, when he saw those pictures, and he couldn't believe those pictures were that clear, and that, you know, he saw everything of his life, things that he didn't know. But he was a very conservative man. And he had a real tough time with me. And in his conservativeness, he thought I was wild and crazy and everything else. But as soon as I started talking about these things, he was engaged and he couldn't disengage himself from the conversation because he was hooked, because he knew it was true, because he was a sensitive, whether his political philosophy or his life philosophy was so or not. And he was a sensitive and he picked up on these things, and yeah, that was certainly true to him. Now, that's one of the consequences of the post-life panorama. That is the stratification of the vital body and the removal from the physical world and all the experiences taken along. There's more that goes with it, but we'll talk about that later on. There's another major consequence, and that is that everything that we have experienced right down to the atomic level that is within all of these pictures, because these pictures are quite miraculous. You can go into them, and if you have the right kind of consciousness, you can expand any part of them. You can have people actually start walking into the pictures with their consciousness, so to speak, and they can do all sorts of things. But everything from the life just finished is built into the desire body. And one of the chief functions of the vital body is building and maintaining, especially maintaining the form and structure of the physical body and of the vital body itself. It is by nature ideally suited for maintaining the vital activity. If we left the vital body all to itself alone, it would vegetate. And it would vegetate without outside interference, and it would just tend, you know, people who are in trances or in comas, sometimes for 30 or 40 years. We just had somebody in Madison here wake up after 40 years in a coma. And it was quite a thing. I was going to save the story, but I didn't. I think it's in the ethers. It's not going to be lost. And the physical body is capable of motion, but without incentive, it wouldn't move, because the vital body would say, why do we have to go to that? We can keep it much better. You know, every kind of motion breaks down tissue. You don't want to be doing that. From the viewpoint of the vital body, it wants to sustain. So motivation and incentive are functions of the higher vehicle, the desire body. Even though we have the capacity to move, we don't move unless we have a desire to move. Now, the desire body is causally antecedent to the vital body, which is a fancy way of saying that there is, we talked about it yesterday, there is a higher kind of cause and consequence. There's cause and consequence on every plane, that there's a tit for a tat, and then there is causation where a higher creates the lower, and the lower creates the formation of the worlds and the bodies and the condensation as the spirit moves into matter is a vertical type of causation. So the desire body is what motivates us to move. The desire body itself has an antecedent. And that antecedent is the concrete mind. There is a thought behind every desire, just like there is a desire behind every motion. And antecedent to all of them and causal to all of them is the spiritual being, the self. The self wills to do something. It intends to do something, and it precipitates a thought. And then that thought becomes a desire. That desire becomes an action, and that action results in an event in the material world. Not all the thoughts become desires, not all the desires become, we're going to talk about this in a couple of days, so we'll just leave it at that. this is, again, that's a hook, that's a preview for coming attractions. It's to draw you in and get you interested in everything. So when the spirit, or the knower, observes all of the actions and events in this 3.5-day period, or maximum 3.5-day period, and the vital body is unwinding, the impulse to hold it together is unwound, and it's left. The experience is carried one layer back in creativity. This is the consequence of all the desires as vital actions is taken back into the desire body. So that at the same time that there is a horizontal cause and consequence, you step on the rake and you get bopped in the head, there is a vertical, so that everything that the desire body has ever produced in the etherical and physical complex is taken back up. And then it takes on, it's like the future of evolution, it takes on the form of everything that was done in the physical world, which means to say that the desire body, as in its normal forward-going functioning activity, is just an ovoid. It is not an emanation from the physical body, as a lot of people try to teach, that you emanate your aura. That's not true. It is the physical etheric is suspended within the desire body. The desire body can live independently of the physical etheric, and it doesn't need them to emanate it. Those vehicles are suspended in it. So things are built into the desire body, and the desire body approximates the shape of the physical body. And we say that it approximates because it isn't exactly the same. Oh boy, I'm lost again in my notes here. Now, earlier we said that in the physical world, shape is all important because that's the purpose of the physical world. It is to produce shapes and forms, and they're meaningful. If you're a swimmer, you might even cut all your hair off because that's enough to change the shape so that you have more drag. You cut all your hair off, you have less drag, and you can swim just a little bit faster. So shape is the all in the physical world. That's not the way it is in the spiritual worlds. In the higher worlds, there are forms and there are shapes, but they are not as important as the inner meaning of them. Earlier, we just said that the inner worlds are inner, and in that innerness, there is a quality or there is a character of spiritual life. And the meaning of our desires is not the shapes that they take, even though the shapes might represent what the desire is. It is the quality, it is the feeling, it is the intent of the desire, and it is especially the intensity of desire that is important. Even the desire body in its effect in the physical body changes the shape. Our muscles are the direct expression of the desire body. If we desire to do something, sometimes it, like anybody who's learned to play piano can tell you that it sometimes takes a few days or weeks to learn to develop new muscles and the nerves to coordinate them so that you can make a movement with your fingers that you couldn't before. So in order to do anything in the physical world, the form is very important. But in the desire body, it is the quality and the intensity that is important. Now, when the desire body takes the shape or approximates the shape of the physical and etheric bodies, there is an important change in the desire. And in that change of desire, the person has a new objective understanding about desires and desire itself, how we relate to the whole principle of desire and function. This is the very same thing that happens in retrospection. In the desire or emotional nature of a retrospector, the person becomes very objective. Because if we don't become objective, retrospection doesn't do us any good. If we just relive the day and get angry with the people that we were angry with before, all we're doing is grinding ourselves more into or reinforcing a desire. Whereas if we learn to judge ourselves objectively and see ourselves objectively, then we can correct ourselves. And we can't really feel what the other person felt unless we do so with objectivity. Some people try to carry something like that overboard, and they try to flagellate themselves or harm themselves. Oh, I've done all this pain to the world and things like that, and they're not really developing an objectivity in that. So there are shapes in the desire world. We've all heard stories about that, and the shapes take on the nature of the desire. Especially, like, take for example, suppose somebody lived exclusively for using their tongue, and they loved to tell gossip, and they loved to tell lots of gossip and really juicy it up so that it was intriguing and exciting, and they do this all the time. This emphasis on what is the tongue in the physical body, in the desire nature, people who go in the desire world talk about some people having an armload of tongue carry around inside of themselves. But it's not that the tongue is that big, it's just that desire to say those nasty things about people is now it's objective. It's shaped like that. So it isn't exactly the same shape as the physical body has always been. There are those extreme shapes. So we hear those kinds of things from clairvoyance. Now there's another facet of this object that is really important. And it's something that we experience here in this world. And it is that the objectivity becomes mandatory. Because the objectivity of this physical world, if you stub your toe on a stone, you know that stone is hard. That's the kind of objectivity we have here. But when you're experiencing the desire world, in the desire world, as a creature of desire, the objectivity there is like you understand the feel and nature of desire. And that is seen in something that we would call grandstand quarterbacking. If you're playing a game of cards, and you've got something involved, and you've got personal feelings involved, you're subjectively looking at it from your point of view. But somebody sitting in the grandstand, somebody looking from they can see the whole playing field, which maybe the quarterback can't see. They can see the way the whole play unfolds. Television uses this all the time. They try to flatter people. They show them the play, and they say, aren't you great that you saw this now? You know, they flatter people and they let them think that they know a whole bunch about sports that they really don't know. I think the most extreme example of grandstand quarterbacking is one that Eddie and I saw one time. We were down in the Students' Union and I was playing chess with this guy. And there were a bunch of people around sitting watching the game. And there was a guy sitting right behind me that was very antsy. And he was watching the chess game, and because he was right behind me, he was watching all of my moves, and it was my turn to move, he'd get really fidgety and things like that, because he knew what the move was supposed to be. His moves weren't always right, what he was thinking, and he'd make noise and things like that. And finally, it got so bad that it was my turn to move, and I was thinking, I didn't make the move. And he reached over and grabbed one of the pieces and moved it. And I got up and I walked out of the place. And he is running behind me. Oh, please come back. And he was trying to grab me by the shirt. But that's what happens. It is an objectivity when you are on the outside. And most of the time in life, we see things from our point of view. We think about our desire. We don't think about the fact that when we're angry with somebody that we're really lambasting them with our desires. But when we are suddenly objective in the desire world, our consciousness is not limited to the desire body anymore. Our desire body is objectively in the whole desire world. Just like in this world, we can look up and we can see the whole heavens. We can see the whole visible universe, at least the part that isn't blocked by the earth. The same thing happens in the desire world. But in the desire world, you are looking from the objective to the subjective. So as a consequence, it feels like you're all over the world at the same time. And it feels like what you gave to the world or what you gave to the other person than what the other person gave to you. So this is really, really, you know, this is the way, the causes and consequences. This is the same way. This is part of the unwinding process. The unwinding isn't done with the unwinding of the vital body. Everything has to return back to the macrocosmic worlds out of which it was created. You know, the universe isn't constantly expanding with new matter. It is a marvelously efficient universe. So we use the same desire material all over again. And so it has to go back to the source before it can be reused. And so we begin unwinding the desire body, and that is one of the ways that it occurs. Oh boy, I got so many things I want to say. I'll try to tell you what happens in all of this. I think about these things, and little by little intuitions come to me in life. And then when I want to put a topic together, I sit for hours in deep concentration, holding my consciousness on what I'm trying to develop, and then writing out notes as complete as I can make them without taking away from everything being extemporaneous and live. But what happens is when you concentrate, your writing becomes very tiny. And if you make your handwriting larger so that it's easier to read, it's distracting from the concentrative state that it would normally take. The tiniest writing that I have ever seen in my life is Albert Einstein's. He had Saturn conjoined Mercury. He had a concentration that you just wish you had something like that. It was really amazing. And so I had these tiny notes, and I've had two eye surgeries a couple months ago, and I can't see clearly at all. All right. What is important in all of this, whether it is retrospection or whether it is after death, is that we neutralize the experience by seeing it from consequence to cause, from seeing it from objective point of view back to the subject. And in that way, we neutralize things, which is the way the unwinding takes place in the desire world. Now we're getting down, I think, to the last page of notes. I've limited myself to 4 pages of notes, but even at that, it tends to be awfully long. Now, even though we have this objective perspective, it doesn't mean that there is a discharge or a neutralization and a harvest and disintegration of the desire body that is automatic. That it happens. We have to actually participate in the process. And the degree, we can be much more efficient. We can go through the process of the disintegration of the vital, the desire body very quickly if we learn how to participate in it. And it's of utmost importance to do that. And our participation has to do with twin forces that work in the desire world and in the desire body. Last year, when we talked about the whole series about the desire world, we said those forces had to do with self-assertion for taking something to you. That is, if you asserted yourself and you say, I want this, whether it's Mideastern oil or whether it is a second helping of Elizabeth's cake, you say, I want this, and you pull it to you, and the effect of that in the desire world is that it has a disintegrating, repulsive effect. Whereas if you love something and without any impediment give yourself to something in love, in a selfless way, that has the force of attraction. Now, obviously, in the creation of the desire body, there is involved the process of giving yourself. Therefore, in order to disintegrate, you use the force of repulsion to disintegrate the stuff of desire world, to put it back to the macrocosmic desire world so it can be used again, and so that you're no longer attached to your desires, and you no longer have to spend all of this time in the lower desire world dealing with those desires. Now, what this means in simple terms is, when you are presented with objective evidence of your own desires coming at you, you can do what a lot of people, there's a common word for it now, it's called denial. You can deny, you can try to alibi and say, well, I really intended to do this, or it really wasn't like that. If you do that, you do not disintegrate the desire. Instead of taking something to yourself in the desire world, when you own up to it and you say, yes, I did that, and you feel with full remorse what you did, that automatically sets the forces of disintegration into effect, and this is how the desire body is broken down. Now, yesterday we said that the effect of desire body, like Max Heindel says, when the desire body was really strong is when we developed the skeleton bones in our body. Now, some people develop desire bodies that are so strong that the normal process after death doesn't disintegrate those desire bodies. And they come back when you're reborn the next time. They're not even disintegrated yet, and they bother you. Somebody was asking that question. Are some forms of schizophrenia being attacked by a second desire body? And that's true. That's perfectly true, because there is a kind of schizophrenia that takes place only in puberty. And it's very common. It's called juvenile schizophrenia. It used to be called dementia praecox. And at puberty is when the old desire, when both desire bodies, the new one and the old one, get activated, and sometimes you respond to one, sometimes you respond to the other. That's not to say that all forms of schizophrenia are that, but that some forms of schizophrenia are that. In fact, in order to be able to tell what kind of insanity is what, you have to be able to be fully clairvoyant, and you have to be objectively trained in what that clairvoyance means. I had a friend that was clairvoyant, and he said, I saw a man who had no aura. And he thought, he didn't believe it was possible to have no aura. And he was seeing something. He wasn't a trained clairvoyant. He probably got it from drugs, if I know him. He said, what's going on? Is it possible to have no aura? And I said, yes, there was an aura. But that was a person that you were looking at. It was somebody who was possessed. They were driven out of their body. And somebody who was of the dead, whose desire body now approximated the physical body, when they inhabited that body, it didn't look like there was an aura. And so it takes a long time to learn what clairvoyance means. And in the meantime, there's no reason why you can't be practicing the spiritual exercises and studying these things. Because somebody who studied these things is very much at an advantage if you start unfolding the spiritual vision, because you know what to look for, and you know, you have some hint of how to understand this. Emanuel Swedenborg, the 18th century clairvoyant who wrote voluminously, tells a story about the purgatory, the lower desire world, that is really amazing. He said there was a fundamentalist, I'm not sure if it was Calvin or not, but there was a fundamentalist who had an enormously long purgatory. Enormously long. Because that person would not believe that he was dead. He said, I know what it's like when you're dead. I know where the Hellfire Lake is and all of that. And he had this conception that he knew what it was like. And because he didn't own up even to the fact that his physical body was dead, he couldn't progress through purgatory. It's the same thing in our lives. If we have a spat with somebody and it's time to make up, it happens much easier if you really own up to what you did. By the way, Barbara Irvin is going to be talking about that tomorrow if she gets here. she was hoping to be here early afternoon, but if you're going east or south, don't go through Chicago, because the worst traffic jam in the history of the United States is in Chicago. Everything's the whole downtown area is all ripped up, and apparently she must have gone right through this. I'm guessing, but I think something that's what happened. All right. Now, several different factors or forces can be active at the same time in any of the worlds. We know that here. For example, if we shoot a rifle or shoot fireworks or something like that, we have two forces that are active at the same time. We have first the momentum that propels something off into space. It tries to go in a straight line. And then the other force is the gravitational force. So that if we shoot a rifle, we have to gauge for the fact that the shell is going to drop, because so it forms an arc. And in every world, it appears that there are several forces or factors that work together. And our stay in the desire world is very much like that. Now, in the desire world, the forces that are most intense predominate. The size of a form doesn't make any difference. Animals see in the desire world. And next door, they used to have a little dog like that that would chase off big German shepherds, because it, in its desire body, had that stronger kind of projection. It didn't care. So that's one force that is at work in the desire world in the life cycle when everything is disintegrating. Now, if we add to this that there are some forms that are more likely to disintegrate, that is, the more repulsive forms. The more selfish one is, and the more out of control one is, those kinds of desires disintegrate most easily. And there is yet another factor. Well, these two factors are enough. There's time. That's the third factor. The unwinding or the disintegrating of our desire body in the desire world does not happen in the same way that it happens in the etheric, panorama. The etheric panorama is exactly in reverse time. In the desire body, the path or the trajectory is different. Certainly, the last things have some priority as their factor, but the most repulsive things and the lowest kinds of desires have to go first. And if you add in the third factor, intensity, if you have someone who has very intense lower desires that happen late in life, like suppose somebody went out in a fit of rage with a Tommy gun killing all kinds of people until the SWAT team knocked them out, that is going to be taken care of first, because that has all three things. So our sojourn in the lower desire world is something that it depends on how well we own up to what we did and how much we take it all with remorse, and how we work with the things that are available to us and what kind of desires we had. Now, if we have some like my mother, it was a very unusual experience. My mother had no what you would call vices. Every now and then she liked to treat herself to a little bit more butter or something like that, because she said, I like this rich taste. But she wasn't what you would call a sensualist. And I think her purgatorial and desire world thing took less than 2 years, and maybe even less than that. And I remember it because I had the most unusual dream. I hardly ever dream of my parents, but in this dream, she came to me as a Christmas tree. And I woke up in the morning, and why would my mother come to me as a Christmas tree? And what she was doing, she was showing me that all of the lights in her desire body You know, they were all lit up, they were all taken care of, and it was all done. And I knew she was gone then, and that she, that, you know, that she had taken care of all of the decorations of her soul nature or something of that nature. It's hard to interpret things like that. Obviously, the higher desires, which last longer, all of the things that have been put into effect by great beings like Christ, who did everything with the most self-sacrificing kind of love. If a person has a taste of those kinds of desires, those are things that last for a very long time, and it shows you something else. It shows you you have to relive the good desires that you did for the world. I recently had an experience with somebody working with a healer who had stigmata, and that person said, in order to be healed, you cannot be negative about yourself. You can't say, I should have done better, or you shouldn't say, you can't say, well, I was bad about this. Or if somebody gives you a compliment, how do you respond to that compliment? And if you respond that you don't accept the compliment, if you can't accept the compliment, you will not accept the gift of healing or the grace of Christ as well. And so if we want to not stay in the higher desire world forever, we also have to accept the fact and objectify and neutralize those higher desires just as we did with all of the lower desires. You know, as we've gotten into an awfully, you know, sometimes one thing leads to another, and it's, you know, it's a downhill kind of thing. And we've gotten into identifying with ourselves as being bad people. And because of that, we almost, you hear conversations where people are almost, if you listen to the effect of their conversation, it's like they're saying, well, I'm worse than you are. It's that kind of a thing. It happens that way. And so what happens is when we have objectified all of our desires and they are disintegrated, the essence of them is built into the seed atom, and it's built into the soul material, which we'll be talking about probably tomorrow evening. But then we see, you know, it's sort of like, it's like archaeology. They find a city and they cover a layer off and they find there's another city behind it. And this is how you rise through the spiritual worlds into regions of greater and greater subtlety, is you realize that there is something behind what you thought was reality. And just as you realize that there was something behind all the actions and that was a motive, at this point you recognize that there is something behind all of your desires and that was a thought. Now, the quality of disintegrating the thought life that we have and the concrete mind that we have is done in a different way, because that's a different world. It is done by attunement. And we do this if we mentally analyze our life or if we mentally analyze anything we do. Ken builds beautiful gardens, and he has an image of what those beautiful gardens are going to be in his mind. And when the garden is built, he can see whether that matched his image or whether in his creative process there were things that he left out. You know, there are all sorts of people that have produced, have imagined and thought out perpetual motion machines, not realizing it was they that was giving the energy to the machine and that it wouldn't be perpetual motion if they weren't in it. And there are a lot of crazy ideas. I had a friend that owned several lots down on Gilman Street, and he was going to put a house on, he was going to put an apartment building for students on it, and didn't take perspective into mind, and the corners would have been hanging out on the street. And so one of the ways is everything in the world of thought is a matter of tone, and it is a matter of attunement. And so you look at the tone of the thought of what actually was. That is the memory in the world of thought versus what you thought you were going to create. That is one kind of way that things, that the objectivity or the neutralization takes place. Another way is that you attune your thoughts to the archetypal thoughts that are from the creative hierarchies. And so in this way, when the tones, some people even describe the process of the disintegration of all of the vehicles and all, you know, in what is called eternal damnation, that this is done as a tonal process, just as everything is created from the universal word, everything is destroyed within the non-being of the universal word, and that when all of the vehicles from all of our lives and all of our previous states of existence are disintegrated, it's done by a tonal process where tone neutralizes tone, and something like that is the way we neutralize things in the world of thought. All right. That is as far as we're going to go this evening. We have now looked at two-thirds of the cycle. We have looked at the cycle of what most people call life. That is the time when we're both looking forward, when we're looking forward to getting married, or we're looking forward to a promotion, and we're at the same time looking backward. And we're looking backward at our children, even more at our grandchildren. That's the first third. The next, but it's not the equal thirds in time, we're just talking about in quality of activity. Now we have looked at the third of the cycle that is only looking backwards. Only looking backwards. There are other activities that are done in the desire world, but those activities in the desire world are as difficult to do as it is for us to retrospect here. Because the impulse here is going forward, and to go backwards, it takes a special assertion of will. And if you are in the unwinding part of the cycle, to try to do something to go forward is very difficult to do. Again, it takes a special act of will, and it takes a practice of being able to do that. This is why it is so difficult, and is only in extremely rare cases that, you know, like you'll hear of a mother coming back to save her child or something like that, because that is like she's trying to do a forward positive action, and only an extreme desire can do that. All right, so we've looked at two-thirds of the cycle, and what we'll look at tomorrow is another very special point, extremely special point, and then we'll look at the last third of the cycle, and then we'll move on. In the last two talks, we'll talk about two other different kinds of cycles, and how we can use them in our spiritual lives. Probably the most important thing that we've talked about tonight is being willing to own everything that you have done. It's nice to own a lot of money and things like that, but are you willing to own every thought, every desire that you have created? Because if you're not, then you're not ready to progress forward in evolution. And so we'll close with the Rosicrucian prayer. Oh God, increase our love for thee so that we may serve thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight.